2 hours and 56 minutes of remaining drive time.
This is Talk is Cheap. I'm your host, DJ Susti, bringing you news analysis from a sustainable truck driver perspective. I'm on my last leg driving back into Eugene on a Friday. It's usually when I do this to pass the time, get me into town after a 14-hour day. All right, so one of the things I'm trying to do with this show is, the main thing I'm trying to do with this show is open a dialogue and encourage critical thinking. And one of the main themes is that the enemy is the aristocratic, militarist, corporatist. The militarist, corporatist, aristocrats are the main enemy, just like they've always been. And that's not a cue for me to play the Who. The old boss is still the same as the new boss. And they tend to divide and conquer is a classic strategy. So, and one of the other themes is that I noticed the far left and the far right have the same enemies. They both blame the government and they both blame a certain group of people. So, and again, that's what the aristocrats want to do, is keep us fighting amongst each other. So they can loot the treasury and keep all the money. And another concept on this show is to know your enemy. So, having said that, and this is why I encourage people to read things like the Turner Diaries is a white supremacist piece of garbage, but you might want to read that because, spoiler alert, the ending of that is a nuclear war between Russia and China wipe themselves out in a nuclear war that's encouraged by the white supremacists. And I don't think Donald Trump even reads books, but there's certainly members of his staff are very similar to what the Turner Diaries advocates. Eerily similar. All right, so knowing your enemy, this is why today I'm going to play this Clive and Bundy issue keeps coming up in the news, although it isn't this week. But Clive and Bundy, who wanted to run cattle on federal land, and he's using this sovereignty defense. And so back in 1999, I recorded a lecture by a guy named Johnny Liberty, who is an advocate of the sovereignty movement. And do not do anything, disclaimer, do not do anything with the sovereignty movement. Johnny Liberty went to jail for tax evasion and fraud. So, don't do what this guy says, but it's interesting, A, to know what these guys are thinking, and B, what's strange is there is some truth to what they're saying, and then they take it off into a bizarre direction, and it is... this is what I'm saying, is they want the same things, because they are aware, they're trying to avoid paying federal taxes, which is true. You should try to avoid paying federal taxes, because they mostly go to pay the interest on war debt. But they're also, there's other concepts that go with the sovereignty movement, one of which is that they think that we're all, and Johnny Liberty will talk about this, that you're all working for the federal government as a slave. And there is some truth to that, that the banks, the international banks, do own this country, basically. And this is why you're seeing, every time we go to war, they're using the country as a collateral, and they're pulling that collateral all the time. And this is why you're seeing, we don't have enough money for healthcare, we don't have enough money for the infrastructure bill this is why you're seeing that he wants the states to pay for the infrastructure. And the parks are bankrupt. The state parks are being basically sold to the highest bidder for advertising, and their advertising space is being sold in the parks. The space program is always looking for money, and there's never enough money for foreign aid. So a word about white supremacists too is just to let you know, I'm not, my sister, I have, my father was like just to the left of Archie Bunker, but my sisters, one has been with a black man since I was basically 8 years old, very nice guy, ex-Vietnam vet, and he was a bank manager. And my other sister has been with a Native American who is kind of like Elvis, not very Native American, but to be honest, but anyway, so my sisters made sure that I did not turn out like my father. And I owned a house in Watts in 2009, and the Grape Street Crips made me an honorary member, but there is no, this was a joke, because there is no, they don't have white people in black gangs. So anyway, but I helped them, I gave them work, and so they all showed up at my house. About 50 of them showed up at my house one day to do work, because they needed to show their parole officer that they had a job. So, anyway, I just want to make sure. So, and then a couple of things about, well, about racism is, there will probably always be racism, because it's partly human nature to want to be around your own ilk. But it is exacerbated by the aristocrats pit us against one another. And if there was, if they would stop looting the treasury, racism would be relegated basically to the front porch with a banjo. Although some of them, we may have to do something with some of them, their gene pool is the size of a thimble, and their father and brother are the same person, and their family tree is a toothpick. I'm here all week. Don't forget to tip your waitresses. Okay, so moving on. Oh, and then, so I want to, this gives me a chance to talk about a little bit about Hamilton. Because what these guys are saying, the white supremacists, the sovereignty movement, and by the way, another problem with the sovereignty movement is it keeps showing up, they use the county sheriff to do things, which is, there is some truth to that, just like in Robin Hood, the county sheriff was a powerful person, because he knew everybody in the county and knew what was going on in the county. But what Clive and Bundy and these guys seem to forget is that there's this thing called the Bill of Rights and the International Bill of Rights. And the Bill of Rights to me is basically stuff that you're taught on the playground to have some decent respect for one another, okay? So this is something that, Clive and Bundy seems to forget that, this is what I've talked to him about before. There is the term ownership. We all own the national forests, or no one owns the national forest, depending on which way you want to look at it. But either way, we have graciously allowed him to run cattle in the national forest, which I really object to. But if, at least if you're going to do that, can you pay us to do that? And you know, beef might have to cost a little bit more to buy beef, and trees too. The national forest up here in Oregon, the road system is the largest in the world. It's the forest, the warehouser does not pay for those roads. You and I pay for those roads, so that they can basically rape the forest with clear cuts. And this is where capitalism, if the warehouser was not subsidized by the taxpayers, partly by giving them roads and giving them free access to the forest, trees would cost a lot more money. So you conservatives out there that don't think that you're the socialists, warehousers is the true socialists. Socialist. They get subsidies. Some would say $1 million a mile to make a forest road, because think about it, you got to haul that stuff in there to make a road, usually not in a very good area, very stable area. Okay, so back to a word on Hamilton, because like I say, these guys advocate, and it's true, they're kind of populism to me. There's liberal populism and conservative populism. Nowadays, they're calling it a conservative movement. My understanding was populism was people against the banks, and this was like the grapes of wrath back in the Great Depression, were farmers and soldiers who were, by the way, back then were Democrats. Populism was to get rid of the aristocrats. So, what these guys are advocating is they're against the banks. They are conservative and they're against the banks, the same as liberals, because it's true, the banks, we should never have had a central bank that is run by private industry, which is what Hamilton advocated. Hamilton is what got us a central bank. Now, I've read Ron Chernow's book, Hamilton. I've not seen Hamilton, I don't know that much about it, but they've said that it is based on Ron Chernow's book on Alexander Hamilton. Now, I've read that book, and I went to his book signing and asked him personally, Ron Chernow, if he felt that Alexander Hamilton had been vindicated about the central bank. In other words, has the central bank been a good thing to have? And depending on you, you ask, that central bank has been a complete disaster. The Federal Reserve is a bunch of private banks, and is whether you're liberal or conservative, it is a main problem with our country. And they use it to fund, this is how they fund wars. As it is right now, banks are required to keep reserves. We have to pay them interest, 6% interest, for them to keep reserves in the bank. Why do I have to pay that? And there's a whole movement right now on public banking, where at least your cities and counties, why do they have to pay a third party? And this is not socialism. Why would your city have to pay a third party for banking interest when they can just make loans themselves for their own backed by taxpayer money, and then the taxpayer pays back the bank rather than pay a private bank? All right, so let's see. Went over I don't want to get into Ron Williams Jennings Bryan was the Populist Party. Again, this is where the evangelicals end up in the Populist Party too. So everyone has been a populist at one time or another. That apparently it's for when you're popular, it's the a popular movement, but I always thought it was about the banks. All right, so what else? Then we'll get into Johnny Liberty. I'm gonna play it in two parts. Oh, and one other thing about Hamilton is, again, I don't know what this thing is about, because I can't afford to go to a Broadway show, so, and I know it's rap. All this talk about Jefferson, yes, Jefferson was a slave holder, and I just want to make one point, is think about what these guys were dealing with. If you've ever read, in the Renaissance, in the Enlightened period, it was after the Dark Ages, where... if you ever read Agony and the Ecstasy, is about Michelangelo and the trials and tribulations this guy had to go through with the church in the dark, just coming out of the dark ages, to make art was incredible. And this is what Jefferson, if you ever read Candide by Voltaire, I still have nightmares about this thing. They still were roasting people alive in basically in Jefferson's time, at least right before Jefferson's time. So I'm not making an excuse for him to that he held slaves and could have definitely freed them when he died, but to negate everything else that he did because of that, I kind of have a problem with. And to compare him to Alexander Hamilton, I mean, we had indentured servants back then too, and Alexander Hamilton did much more damage by keeping you, because the banks are how they facilitate slavery as well as war. So let's see what else. I'm running from a so yeah, Know Your Enemy, coming up, Johnny Liberty in two parts, recorded here in Springfield, Oregon in 1999. Again, don't do the sovereignty movement. Oh, one other thing about the sovereignty movement is, just to give you an example, Disneyland is a sovereign state, the Disneyland in Anaheim. They granted him the state of California and the federal government, I believe, granted him a sovereign nation. Disneyland is a sovereign nation, and this is how they got away with, for years they would not allow gay dancing in Disneyland because they felt they didn't have to follow the Bill of Rights. So this is the problem with the sovereignty movement. I thought it would be something, anything, I'm in favor of anything, even if you're Charles Manson, if you got a way not to pay federal taxes, I will go to your lecture. Jeffrey Dahmer, if you have a way not to pay federal taxes, I'm listening. So that's why I went to this guy. However, like I say, this guy ended up in jail for tax fraud, and everyone in the sovereignty movement that has tried this has ended up in jail or paid huge fines. So do not try this at home. apparently there's a difference between a tax protester and a tax resister. I suggest you look into tax resistance, although none of them have been successful at it either. The way to get around this, what I think is going to happen here is, although they'll probably crack down on this too, is this is where the cryptocurrency is. You're getting away from the international banks and the internet and the IRS. So again, do not follow the sovereignty movement. You will probably end up in jail. Without further ado, Johnny Liberty.
Message text. Good morning. The Manteca and Modesto terminals on average are 8 cents more than the pricing is flying JLOD, and love this ribbon. In Central California, the Fresno terminal is about 8 cents more than the pricing of love 2 or going up the 90 high, and the Fresno terminal is about 15 cents more than the pricing of the Tabernacle or going up the 5.
White males in the North who had still retained their sovereignty after the Civil War, and you had the newly freed black slaves and the former prisoners of war all being second-class citizens. And women didn't become second-class citizens until they got the vote. Women got the shaft too. They didn't get sovereignty. They got the civil right to vote. What's a civil right? It's a right given by the government. If the government can give you a right, it can take it away. It's different than a right that can't be taken away. because it's there by the nature of natural law, common sense. And so this two-tiered system, this double standard, has been here for a long time in this country. And the power structure has known it all along. Who do you think retained their sovereignty? Most of the American power structure that has profited to develop most of the corporations and the infrastructure for the system we have in place today knew the distinction. Always knew the distinction. But most of the American people forgot who they were. And it was a slow and gradual process, like a frog slowly boiling in the pot. It wasn't until after the Great Depression and the passing of the Social Security Act that most of the white citizens of the North started giving up their sovereignty when they got their Social Security number. SS number. That's your slave number. What is a U.S. citizen distinct from a sovereign citizen? What are these two standards or two classes of citizenship? Before 1868, there was only the white male property owners who were sovereign state citizens. And why so? Well, because it was written in the state constitutions. The states determine citizenship. And that's what those state constitutions said. White males could be citizens. Before 1868, there was only one citizen. After 68, there were two classes of citizenship. The U.S. citizen is not a citizen at all. The 14th Amendment is all persons born or naturalized in the United States shall be United States citizens. Now, in the language of law, if you start studying a little bit more and get involved and hit the law books and hit the history books, you'll have to learn the language of law because it's very precise. It's like learning a foreign language, Chinese or Japanese. Law is its own language. Every word has its own definition. What's a person? In law, a person has a specific definition. A person is a legal fiction like a corporation or a trust. A U.S. citizen is a legal person. All persons, born or naturalized, what's a person? In law, it's one thing. In your colloquial understanding of the word, it's another. Most of us went to public school. We learned our vocabulary in government schools. And in government school, they taught you about persons. We often refer to each other as persons, don't we? While we never mention the word sovereignty. Isn't that interesting? Yes, a conspiracy of ignorance. Nothing more. So there's this distinction. What is a U.S. citizen? A U.S. citizen is property of the federal government. Property. Whenever you get a benefit or a privilege for the government, you have to give them something for it. The newly freed black slaves were asking for federal government protection, and in exchange, they had to give their allegiance. They had to give their allegiance to the federal government, and they had to also be subject to the tax to pay for the benefit of protection. And the same is true of every U.S. citizen. Whenever you get a benefit or privilege from the government, believe me, you are paying for it dearly. And whether it's a driver's license or a vehicle registration or a marriage license or whatever, each of these contracts has its own adhesions to it, like glue. And every time you enter into a government, you give up something. Wouldn't be a contract if you wouldn't. You give me something, I'll give you something. Government gets your rights. Get your property in exchange for you get privileges and civil rights. But that's not the way it's supposed to be. And so from that time forward, today, if you look to the state constitutions, by the way, you'll see that there's no longer a stipulation on citizenship that white males are only the only citizens. Those have all been amended, every one of them. It now just says citizen. The federal government has no citizenship. Because the federal government is a corporation, just like McDonald's, just like the Municipal Corporation of Springfield, that we have the privilege of being in their city hall tonight. And I say their city hall because this is their corporate headquarters. A corporation like the federal government can't have citizens. You can have members, but you have to volunteer into it, like being one of the Boy Scouts or a Girl Scout. The board of directors for the Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts can pass bylaws and laws, but who's subject to them? Only the members of the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts, who are subject to federal laws, who are subject to federal jurisdiction in the states, U.S. citizens. One of the things that we gave, that we transferred, we went into their venue and into their jurisdiction, and thus are subject to those federal laws. Originally, when the Constitution was set up and this government was formed, and I'll explain in very simple fashion something they need to teach in every civics class, which they failed to teach, is that the way America was founded, based on the sovereignty of the individual, is that a sovereign individual or groups of sovereign individuals got together. When you got 12 or 24 sovereign individuals together, they could form a common law court, a grand jury, or a township. When a bunch of townships get together, they form counties. A bunch of counties get together, they form states. A bunch of states get together, they form a union of states. And then and only then did they write the Constitution and create the federal government in the District of Columbia. 63 square miles, period. The federal government had no jurisdiction within the states. The states were and are sovereign, as the people who are citizens of those states are sovereign. And even the 9th and 10th Amendments of the Constitution said, to restate what was obvious to the people at that time, was that the federal government had very limited jurisdiction, limited authority in a limited area. And it was only created for a few small functions, for commerce, to maintain a navy, to coin money, for international treaties and international diplomatic relationships. That was it. There were three federal laws. How many federal laws do we have today? Gazillions of them. So many laws and so many rules and regulations, not even whole legions of attorneys can sort it all out. There's at least 67,000 pages of regulations regarding the harvesting of beets. So the little box that was created, the Constitution under the Republic, was a box for the federal government. It was a limitation. It said, look, we don't really trust creating a national government, but we're going to do it because, you know, maybe we can manage it. We're going to experiment and try and see if it works, see if we can keep you in the box. Well, they tried to keep the federal government in the box, and they succeeded for quite some time. Federal government had no authority in the states. They had to, if the federal government ever wanted to come into the states, they had to get permission of the local county sheriff. They still do, in fact. Federal police and federal government can't come into the states and enforce any criminal statutes. That's the domain of the states and the counties to do. So the little box that we created with the Constitution, reserving all rights not specified in the Constitution with the 9th and 10th Amendments, relegated back to the sovereignty of the people. So if we didn't give you authority in the Constitution, you haven't got it. Period. And so what's happened from the point of the birth of the Republic to about the Civil War? Before the Civil War, the states were still in charge. After the Civil War, guess who was in charge? Federal government. Our own federal government went to war with the states so that it could be supreme and begin a long encroachment upon the sovereignty of the people in the states up to the present day. And now, as we know, the federal government affects every aspect of everything that we do. Not because they have any jurisdiction here, but because, one, we became U.S. citizens, and thus we became little walking federal areas. You know what a federal area is? It's some area over which the federal government has jurisdiction. When you got your Social Security number, you became a little walking federal area, over which they now have jurisdiction over you. And as more and more people became U.S. citizens, suddenly they had more and more influence, more and more impact in the state. And so reclaiming our sovereignty, reclaiming state citizenship, et cetera, is about releasing those adhesion contracts, getting back to the original jurisdictions within the states, reforming them, in fact. We have to rebuild them from the bottom up again. I wish we could just all go fill out a form and become sovereign. It's not that easy. Because sovereignty begins here in the heart and soul of every human being. And you've got to be sovereign and act sovereign and take responsibility. So what are these common law courts about? What are provisional governments about? What's going on in the patriot movement in this country is that people are starting to step up, they're standing up, and they're saying, I'm going to take charge of my life. And I'm going to do it with other people. Because we need each other. It's lonely being a sovereign out there all by yourself. But when groups of sovereign individuals get together, they can reclaim their rights. They can reclaim due process. They can restore the Constitution under the Republic, not under a democracy. Because in a democracy, you don't have any rights. You as citizens ain't got no rights. You ain't got no due process. You ain't got no country. Been sold down the river for a few privileges. And so to take our country back, we have to restore the Republican roots. Now please, don't confuse a republic with a Republican. And don't confuse a democracy with a Democrat. That's a fatal mistake. Because what goes on in Washington, D.C. has very, very little to do with republic versus democracy. There's only one party in D.C. and it's the money party. And they're the ones responsible for selling our country down the river to foreign powers, to international bankers. And the ones who direct and control the affairs of the federal government are the creditors. Anybody pay attention last month or the month before when the government closed its doors for a few weeks? It's had some financial problems. Gee, I thought the government had lots of money and you had good security having a government job. Well, I think there's a lot of unessential, non-essential federal workers that may be thinking twice about their futures with the federal government or the state government or the county governments. They're all on the brink of bankruptcy, every one of them. When the government closed its doors 6-7 weeks ago, it went bankrupt again. Not the first time. At least 8 or 9 times that I've got from the public record in this century. And they're going to go bankrupt again next month. So the government that we have is very insecure and very unstable because it made some mistakes. We made some mistakes too because we let it happen. And it happened when, through the Federal Reserve Act in 1913, we created a federal bank and we gave the country up to the international bankers. We said, look, we the people don't want to take that much responsibility anymore. Let's let the bankers do it for us. There's lots of bankers, by the way, and I don't make this very clear. Because every time I point out that the Federal Reserve System, which is an international bank, one of 17 international banks, happens to be in charge of the political, economic, and legal system of this country, the immediate response from our critics are that we're anti-Semitic. I'm not saying who's in charge of the international banks. There's all kinds of people in charge of the international banks. There's Jewish bankers, there's European bankers, there's South African bankers, there's Russian bankers, there's Japanese bankers, there's all kinds of bankers out there. There's at least 40 different overlapping, intersecting power structures in charge of the New World Order today. This isn't an anti-Jewish conspiracy to point out the fact of how the economic system actually runs. And the way the economic system runs is right now it runs on debt. Does anybody have a hard time making the bills last month? Anybody feeling the pinch? Anybody you know lost their job or downsized corporation or homeless on the street? Or incarcerated. These are the symptoms of an undeclared federal bankruptcy. The only thing that goes on in Washington, D.C., the only thing on their agenda is to stave off the ultimate bankruptcy of the federal United States and the closure of that government structure and its replacement with another structure that's imposed from international places, from world government. The only thing on that agenda is to keep that power structure alive a few days longer. Keep raising the debt ceiling. And every time they do, the government has to get a little bit more aggressive with its hand in your back pocket. So if you think that government collection activities have been accelerating recently, they have been. Why are there more police on the street? Because we're fighting crime, remember? The war on crime, the war on poverty, the war on drugs. War, war, war. The only thing we know how to do in America anymore. The reason there's more police on the street so they can raise more revenue. So they can keep the bankrupt governments open a few more days, write a few more citations, create a few more licenses, raise the fees, raise the fines, raise the taxes. Instead of one hand in your back pocket, they got two now. And it's all because of the bankruptcy. This is not a theory. You can see it in the congressional record. It's written down. They declare it now and again, right on the floor of Congress. And here we are, Mr. Speaker. In Chapter 11, bankruptcy is the largest corporation in the history of the world. And what happens when a corporation goes bankrupt? What happens when you go bankrupt? Anybody here gone bankrupt? When you go bankrupt, whether Chapter 7, 11, 12, or 13, you transfer the authority to negotiate your assets to your creditors. Go to bankruptcy court and you hand over what you got left to the judge. He appoints a trustee, and the trustee determines how to divide up what you got left amongst those creditors that are around. What happens when the government goes bankrupt? Congress, who are the trustees in the receivership of the bankruptcy, get together and decide how they're going to parcel up your property and hand it over to the international bankers as collateral. That's the only thing that goes on in Washington, D.C. The rest of it's political positioning, bids for re-election, presidential campaigns, and all that other nonsense. And all that talk about balancing a budget in 7 or 12 years is the biggest bunch of horsewash I've ever seen. One, because whether it's 7 or 12 years, it's too late, folks. And all those guys know they're going to be out of office by that time anyway, within 7 to 12 years. They're all retiring this year, in fact, because they know the heat's gone right now. The heat is on. You've never seen more incumbents retire from office than you did this year. Because the heat's on. Because they don't want to be around when the shit hits the fan. So, you can be encouraged by that. So maybe a whole new breed is going to rise up to the occasion of self-governing. But we have to clean up the political system. We got to clean up the political process and get beyond this partisanship. Get beyond left and right. This isn't a rightist agenda. We are not extremist right-wing groups. All right? Get that through your head. This is especially for the media if you're still here. You can call us that, you can label us that, it doesn't make us that. This is not right or left. I brought a little sign there tonight to appeal to all the environmentalists around. Truth is an endangered species. In fact, it's to appeal to everybody, not just the environmentalists. It's to appeal to everybody. Truth is an endangered species. Let's get our heads straight. Let's look to each other, support each other, build community. It's going to take us taking responsibility because we're not going to elect anybody into that system that's going to do anything about it. Guaranteed. And so what's happening around the country today? I would estimate there's 1 million Americans have reclaimed their sovereignty in the last 3-4 years. There are literally 20,000 or more groups and organizations meeting every night of the week. Small groups, big groups, in living rooms, in churches, in schools, at City Hall sometimes. I did a workshop for 150 people right above the governor's office about a year ago up in Salem. I was hoping that they had tapped the ceiling so maybe they would listen. I was hoping they would listen in. I was hoping that somebody might be here tonight that could go back and knock some sense into our public officials. And so what's going on around the country is that people are meeting and they're starting to gather and they're starting to begin the process of reclaiming their sovereignty, beginning with an educational process. And there is a number of materials out there, and I'll share just a few things with you at the end here of some of the things we've done, that we've offered up. There's a book I've written called The Sovereign American's Handbook. It's a virtual encyclopedia, political issues and concerns. You can put it up there just people can see it. This week I'm finishing a book called The Sovereign Hawaiian's Handbook, which is for the Hawaiian sovereignty movement, to unify all the many factions of the Hawaiian sovereignty movement so they can reclaim independent nation status. Not just be an Indian reservation, but complete independence. The state of Hawaii no longer exists. It's not part of the union anymore. Public Law 103-1050 November 23, 1993, an act of Congress signed by Bill Clinton. Handed Hawaii back to the Hawaiians. All they've got to do is ready themselves for self-government. They've got to stand up and say, I am ready, I will make myself ready, and I will learn what it takes so that I can govern myself. So that I don't have to have foreign powers here dictating to me. The same is true in America. We will have foreign powers on our soil, reaching in our back pocket until we take responsibility. So there's common law courts being formed all around this country. I know the media is hot on the topic right now, because I don't think they understand really the depth of it or the nature of it. The common law court movement, if I might call it that, not really a movement. It's really completing something that got started several hundred years ago in the Constitution. Remember, the people were sovereign. What does it mean to be a sovereign? It means that you retain full judicial power. It is not up to the courts to determine what is constitutional. It's up to the people to determine what's constitutional. The Constitution is not subject to interpretation by courts, by judges, by legal scholars, etc. Its intent was very, very clear and very literal. There was no mystery behind it. And if there was an interpretation, if there was, it was to be retained by the people in the common law process. See, most of us were taught, and we believe still, that there were supposed to be three branches of government. No, there were intended to be two, the legislative and the executive. The judicial branch, the common law, was to be retained by the people. How else could you expect to keep government limited? How else could you exercise a check and balance against the unlimited growth of government? How else could you apply a check to your public officials if you didn't have judicial review? And so the one Supreme Court, the Article III Supreme Court, was intended to be one Supreme Court. We the people in its entirety. We are the court. All of us. We can hold court right now. We can quiet title, reclaim our status, and form a judicial body called the Common Law Court. It's not something esoteric or strange. But what happened by 1789 in the First Judiciary Act, foreign powers and attorneys and esquires started monopolizing the court system very early on. And we never completed what we started. The people went back to gardening and hunting and farming, and they didn't finish constructing the common law court. So all the courts that we presently have, all the Article I courts that are operating, are commercial courts, or statutory courts, or equity courts, or admiralty courts, or military courts. And the common law court is virtually non-existent in that system. They've obliterated the common law. Today, down at the university, they held a press conference, and there was a constitutional scholar that said that the Constitution, there was no common law in the Constitution. Well, which one are you talking about? Which Constitution? You mean the one that started after the Civil War when the federal government decided it was supreme? That's the Constitution you're talking about. But before that, there was a whole different Constitution. That's the one I'm talking about. And so by retaining judicial power, we can exercise a check against unlimited power of government. If the government violates your rights, you as a sovereign individual have recourse and remedy under the common law. You don't have it in the justice system, the so-called justice system. Most people have about the same amount of access to the courts as the Christians had to the lions. Can't find remedy and recourse in there. They're going to grind you up. You're not going to get due process in that system. It's the wrong venue for you. And they've admitted it. I think that we're getting the kind of treatment that we're getting in the press regarding the common law courts because I think they did not anticipate that the people would ever figure it out and then actually take any action around it. Right now, there's 70,000 people active in the common law court movement alone in this country. There are hundreds and hundreds of common law courts. If you can't find remedy in the Article I courts, come on over. Come on into the Article III courts. You can find remedy and recourse there. In fact, these are the highest courts in the land, and that's the beauty of it. And they don't know any way out of it. And even their own courts have acknowledged it. Both the 10th and the 9th Circuit Courts of Appeal have acknowledged it in several cases that these common law courts are courts of competent jurisdiction. because that was what was always intended. And so these courts are valid, and their writs are valid. So besides the common law courts, what else is occurring? Well, there's several states that have formed provisional governments. Hawaii did it 2 years ago. After public law, they formed a provisional government, which is a government that comes before a transitional government, which comes before reestablishing a de jure government, a lawful government. Texas formed the New Republic of Texas, December 13, 1995. Colorado has a provisional government. What we have had for so long is we've got a de facto government. We've got a government that's bankrupt, that pretends to be a government, but it obeys no laws. It has no laws as its foundation. Its only law is the law of expedience. How quickly can I extort your property and your rights? There's no standard there. There's no lawful process. There's no sworn complaints on those citations you get. There's not even any statutory authority for a police officer to write a single citation in the state, except for DWI and felony hit and run. Those are the only two things they have any statutory authority to. We didn't write the laws, we're just saying we studied them thoroughly. And we would like to see these laws reinstituted, reconstituted, and there be one standard of justice for all the people. And that's beginning to happen in America today. And so besides cleaning up the political process, learning how to work within the judicial process, and how to reclaim our own sovereignty, we have to also restore sustainable economic systems, because it's the key. There's no common law in the Article I courts because the country went bankrupt. And when the country went bankrupt, it could no longer operate at law. There are no lawful contracts. There's no valid mortgage contracts, not one of them. There's not a valid credit card debt out there. They're all frauds. By their laws, not mine. I didn't write the law. It says it right there, right in plain English. And so to clean up this whole process and to restore a sustainable economic system means that people are going to have to work together and get back to the roots of what really builds an economy, because it ain't about money. This stuff here that we call money is the primary means that we are controlled by international power structures. It controls our behaviors, what we can buy, what we can't buy, how much credit we have. It's all a debt-based system. And in a debt-based money system, it ain't money. It's paper. Money substitute. In fact, to be very literal, they're commercial liens. All the paper in your pocket are commercial liens. The checks you write are commercial liens. A lien is an encumbrance upon property. And remember, since the country went bankrupt and we gave up all of our rights and became United States citizens, the government now has a lien on all of our property and our rights. So from their system of law, from the commercial system of law, they got their hands in your back pockets because you're their property and they have a lien on you. You heard the old song, "Lean on Me," right? Lean on me, right? Well, that's what the government does. They lean on you. And who leans on the government? The international banks. Everybody's leaning on everybody. When we buy and sell, use Federal Reserve notes, we're leaning on each other. We're not buying and selling anything. We're just putting liens on each other. Not a very neighborly thing to do, is it? But that's the essence of and the root of our economic behavior. And so to get back to a sustainable economic system means first we got to start producing real goods and services that are needed and wanted. And stop just shuffling paper around and working like slaves for Federal Reserve notes.